This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The latest round of military aid for Ukraine and for Israel has been held up in Congress, not because of spending concerns, but because of border security. Republicans rejected a spending package earlier this month demanding stricter immigration measures. House Speaker Mike Johnson reportedly told his colleagues that changes to immigration policy would be their hill to die on.
We have to affect real policy change at the border, and that is a necessary condition to anything we do going forward.
Democrats accuse the Republicans of holding military aid hostage. Pramila Jayapal, the leader of the Progressive Caucus, says the sweeping changes that Republicans want would only destroy the country's asylum system.
I think we need to put our foot down and say, no, vote on the aid package without those border policy changes and recognize that some of the things that the Biden administration have been doing have really been working.
The border is surely going to be at the center of the presidential race in 2024. The wall, of course, has always been an obsession for Donald Trump, but the issue has reached beyond partisan politics throughout the year. Congressional Democrats and some big city Democratic mayors are pleading for more federal support. The city of San Diego, for example, is squeezing dry what's left of their pandemic aid in an attempt to support asylum seekers. That's money that's likely to run out entirely by the end of this month. New York City's Mayor Eric Adams says he's spent nearly $1.5 billion this year to address the migrant crisis. And that, in turn, has set off a more general budget crisis in New York. Libraries are closing their doors earlier, and there are deep concerns about numerous other city services. Staff writer Dexter Filkins spent time at the southern border this year to talk with local officials and with migrants about their reality. We spoke back in June. Dexter, for a long time, you've mainly been a foreign correspondent for us and for the New York Times. Earlier, you've written about conflict in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, all over the world. And now you've spent months reporting on the border between the United States and Mexico. What were you witnessing, and had you ever experienced anything similar before?
Well, I think there's no way I could have imagined what I saw or what I encountered. I mean, I think you need to It's difficult to appreciate the scale and the magnitude of what's happening there unless you see it.
Well, tell us about your experience. Where did you fly to? What were your impressions? What did you see?
Well, I went to a bunch of different places all up and down the border. So I was in, I think I started in El Paso. I made a bunch of trips to a little town called Del Rio. I went to another place called Eagle Pass. So I was kind of like working my way up and down, depending on sort of what was happening and who told me what. And then I went out, and this is in the piece, but I went out with up in a helicopter with the state troopers in Texas.
But what are the numbers?
They're astounding. I think about 4 million people, as best as I could count, have come into the country since then. And that's, it's a lot of people. It's bigger than a lot of states.
And that's 4 million people who are going to stay in the United States?
No, I mean, probably about 1.5 million of those people are what the Border Patrol calls gotaways, which is they're basically counted, but they're not apprehended, either by they've seen them on cameras or sensors or whatever. 2.5 million. This is a lot of the piece is an attempt to explain the other 2.5 million, which is, I will be persecuted by my home country if you send me back. What's really striking, overwhelming, is the numbers of people who are coming.
And where are those people coming from? Not just Mexico. They're not just Mexicans.
Oh my gosh, they're coming from everywhere, everywhere in the world. Tajikistan, Burkina Faso, China. The numbers are amazing, but also just the diversity of people who are coming across. You have to try to visualize it. There's border walls, there's fences, there's all kinds of things, but they're in the places where there's a border wall, they can't build a border wall in the middle of the river. So if you can get across the river and you can get your foot on American soil, that's all you need to do.
Why did the numbers change so radically in 2021?
That's a really good question. One of the questions I tried to answer, I think the short answer is Trump's rhetoric, President Trump, deterred a lot of people. I mean, he basically said, I don't want you people. You're from these terrible countries. Stay out. And he was, you know, very, very, you know, brutal in his language about it. And at the same time, there was the pandemic. And so you can look at the numbers. They sort of drop when the pandemic begins. To answer the question of why did the numbers skyrocket, which they did, Joe Biden in his campaign for president, and I think he and the party, the Democratic Party, rejected basically the whole Trump vision of the border and of immigration, and so Biden literally said on many occasions, if you're feeling persecuted, if you are persecuted, come and make your case. In fact, he did that in one of the presidential debates that also happened to be co-hosted by Univision, the big network. And so his critics would say he invited people in, and that's pretty strong language, but it's not inaccurate.
I would, in fact, make sure that we immediately surge to the border. All those people are seeking asylum. They deserve to be heard. That's who we are. We're a nation that says if you want to flee and you're fleeing oppression, you should come. I would change the order that the president just changed.
Look, the problem here is that the American immigration system is antiquated. It's too small. It's completely broken. It's too old. And Congress, you know, in its mutual animosity, has been unable and unwilling to fix it. And so we're kind of stuck with this system that doesn't work, that was designed for something, you know, a reality that hasn't existed for decades. And at the same time, you have these extraordinary numbers of people who are coming in part because of the terrible political and economic conditions in Latin America and in Central America and other parts of the world. So, for instance, Venezuela, which has produced the political turmoil and the economic collapse there, has produced 7 million refugees.
Dexter, you met a lot of migrants in your reporting. Is any of their stories particularly strike you as either particularly moving or emblematic of what's happening now?
I met a woman named Julie. She's Colombian. She's gay. Was being routinely beaten by her family. She couldn't live in her country anymore. As she said, I couldn't get a job because I was being discriminated against. My partner, we were disgraced. We had to go. We decided to make the journey, and this is. Every single person that crosses the border has a story like this. It's the journey. And so she makes this, she and her partner and her young child make this epic journey. And they pretend that they're tourists. They go to Cancun, Mexico. Then they make this long, long bus journey to the border, to the American border. They're robbed the whole way up. They basically run out of money. They're begging, borrowing, doing everything they can. They finally piece together the money. This takes weeks and weeks and weeks. They find a smuggler. They give the smuggler essentially all the money that they have, and they get across the border. And she's in New York now, one of 70,000 or so immigrants who've come. But it's crushing because you realize the world's full of people like Julie, and what
because the world is full of violence and instability and
yes.
climate change and all yes. the factors that lead to this.
Yeah, yeah.
Every time there's a political campaign, if the candidate himself is not a Trumpist and is particularly cruel about the issue of immigration, you will hear the phrase, sensible immigration reform.
Yeah.
Everybody's for sensible immigration reform, and there have been attempts in our recent history to have so-called sensible immigration reform. What was it, and why did it fail?
Well, so the last time the Congress came pretty close to reforming the system was 2013. And
during Obama.
Yes, complete overhaul of the system was passed in the Senate in 2013. And basically the kind of outlines of any compromise are they're sensible, but they're also like pretty predictable. The Republicans want greater border security and the Democrats typically want sort of more legal immigration. And that's basically what was in that bill. And what happened really was they sent it over to the House. This was as the Tea Party was kind of gaining momentum, and they couldn't get the votes, and it hasn't ever come back. Trump comes along 2 years later, 2015, and launches his campaign, and that has changed everything.
People, criminal aliens. We will begin moving them out day one, as soon as I take office.
And more than a couple of people explained this to me, political people, who said, you know, what the Republicans wanted was, you know, they don't want chaos at the border. They want, and, you know, and this includes voters, they don't want chaos at the border. And they want, you know, kind of a legal, orderly processes for immigration. And if you can do that, people will support it.
But do they only want immigration from Norway?
Well, but that's what's changed, is that is no longer true. Trump essentially came along and changed the vision of the Republican Party. When the Democratic senators would go into the room in 2013 and say, like, here's our proposal and here's yours and, like, let's hammer something out, they weren't that far apart. Now they're far apart. I mean, now they're just – I mean, as one Democratic senator puts me, there's no appetite for it anymore in the Republican Party.
You said the system is broken and that it's an incredible mess and chaotic. Describe for us what that looks like.
Well, for starters, there's not enough Border Patrol agents on the border. There aren't enough immigration judges to hear cases. The whole system is overwhelmed. It's a series of gigantic bottlenecks. And so if you come into this country, get your foot on American soil, ask for asylum, you're not going to get a hearing on that case, on your case, for on average 4 or 5 years. And then if you lose.
So where are you living? How are you well, living your life in those 4 or 5 years?
Well, you can see by looking at the way the system works, it's just a series of like ad hoc decisions and workarounds. And so as more than a couple people put it to me, once a person gets in the country, they're in for a good decade because they can appeal their case and it'll sort of go on forever. So nothing really works the way it was supposed to work. Nothing.
Among the many people you talk to for this story, there's the former Democratic mayor of Del Rio, Texas, Bruno Lozano. Tell me about him and the phone call that he received while he was mayor from the Border Patrol chief. What happened there?
Well, Del Rio is like a little town or kind of a small city. It's like 35,000 people. Mayor Lozano said to me, he was the mayor in 2021, and he said, I got a phone call one day from the Border Patrol, and they said, we're expecting 10,000 migrants to cross the river at Del Rio by the end of the week. And, you know, he just said, what are you talking about? And this is a Democratic mayor. This is not an anti-immigration mayor. And he just flipped out. He said, you got to be kidding me. 10,000 people? It turned out to be 16,000 people. And at one point, he said there were 1,000 people crossing the river every hour. And they all were sort of brought under a bridge. But it was basically a city sprung up kind of overnight among this, you know, pretty small city. And so Mayor Lozano just, it basically broke him, I think. The city was completely overwhelmed. He couldn't deal with it. He's a Democrat. Very angry at the Biden administration. Feels like he was let down. But more important, he literally said to me, "I can't govern the city. I can't do it because it's not in my control anymore. What happens here?" So he basically gave up. He didn't run for another term.
What has the Biden administration proposed in specific terms, in policy terms?
I think in the first week and upon taking office, President Biden put forward a comprehensive proposal to reform the immigration system. I think not terribly unlike the 2013 proposal. Dead in the water. It didn't go anywhere. So he's trying. But absent that, it's an impossible situation. For instance, a federal judge ruled about a decade ago that the immigrant children crossing the border cannot be detained for more than 20 days. So they have to be released into the country. And so now that sounds like a very humane decision. But the result of that has been, since then, an enormous surge of migrant children coming across the border, some of them unaccompanied. Their parents bring them to the border. They send them across. And because typically, you know, a child comes with his or her parents, they can't be detained either. So that's kind of what you're dealing with, which is like you want to do this, but you can't do that. Like President Obama, who was very tough on illegal immigration, he tried to detain children and families and was basically blocked from doing it. It kind of fell apart. So all the presidents, Trump, Obama, Biden, they all have faced the same problem, which is they can't get Congress to act. So they can only act on their own. And
through executive order.
Yeah. And there's just a very limited number of things they can do.
Dexter, you wrote that under Biden, remarkably fewer immigrants have been placed in deportation proceedings. So how does that jibe with the other numbers you've been discussing?
When President Biden came into office, there was a kind of overriding sense of we have to reverse everything that Donald Trump did. And they did. And the result of that was a deluge. And that's what we've been seeing basically over the last 6 months, which is Biden has been reversing course and becoming much tougher on immigration. In fact, he's imposing programs and proposals that look remarkably like some of the ones that Donald Trump was doing.
For example?
Well, for example, there's a rule called the transit ban, which basically means if you show up at the border and you ask for asylum, you have to prove that you've been rejected for asylum by another country that you passed through on the way here. That would disqualify a lot of migrants. When Trump did that, people went insane. And another example is Remain in Mexico. Remain in Mexico was a Trump program, which was you want to apply for asylum, you can, but you're just going to get an appointment and you can sit down in Mexico until we call you and tell you to come.
Now, Dexter, in your piece, you outline the Biden administration's current parole policies. So a migrant is given a document ordering him to go to ICE on a specified day in the city of his destination. Is this policy for all migrants or only the ones who seek asylum? What's been the reaction to these parole policies?
That's basically what you get if you're seeking asylum. So, you know, you get to the border and you get on American soil, you say, I want asylum. I want to apply for asylum. I'm going to be persecuted if I go back. They hand you a piece of paper. And the Border Patrol guy says, where are you going? He says, well, I got a cousin in Chicago. So he goes to Chicago. And there's a piece of paper, and it says, please report to, you know, with your name and address and an ID, et cetera, et cetera. Please report to the Department of Homeland Security, the ICE office in Chicago. And then down at the bottom, and I saw a bunch of these, it'll say, you will likely to wait, you know, the average wait time for your hearing is, you know, 1,752 days, whatever. So in other words, like check in with the ICE office when you come in and then expect to get a phone call from us in like 3 or 4 years.
Dexter, not so long ago, you wrote a terrific profile of Florida governor and presidential candidate, Governor DeSantis. It's been reported that migrants are leaving Florida because of DeSantis's anti-immigration law in Florida, which is called SB 1718. Did we see anything nationally like that during the crackdown of the Trump era?
We didn't. That was part of the law that I think you're referring to is essentially a worker. The employer has to verify the citizenship of the. What we found in the past in the last really big overhaul of the immigration system was 1986. That became unworkable very, very quickly, and for a whole bunch of reasons. But it's like, what are we going to, you know, we're going to have national ID cards? You know, how are we going to do this? And it becomes very, very intrusive and very difficult. And it didn't work that well the first time. You know, maybe it'd be different the second time. But I think as to Florida, boy, he's skating on. I mean, that's pretty. I don't know if it's thin ice, but you know, when you take a community like Miami, which is completely dominated by, I mean, Miami's a Latin city. It's a Latin American city. And it's filled with refugees and the children of refugees. And so he's going to have to find a way to explain that to them.
Dexter, Republicans often accuse Democrats, maybe just Democrats on the left, but Democrats usually in general, of being for quote unquote open borders. What does that mean? And is, in fact, anyone in the Democratic Party or in Congress for open borders?
That's a super catchy phrase. Everybody knows what it means. The border's not open. I mean, Biden over the past couple of years has turned around more than 2 million people at the border. It's incredibly vigorous enforcement. It's just that the problem is enormous, and a lot of people have come in. When Republicans or anyone else says the border's open, you know, that's meant to, it's a very emotional term. It's meant to evoke images of, you know, giant hordes of people flooding, you know, the country and flooding American cities. But it's not, the border's not open in any sense.
As we said, you grew up in Florida where immigration is extremely vivid. You live in New York City. How did your experience at the southern border change your perspective on the extent of the immigration problem and what should be done about it?
I didn't realize how, you know, you can look at the numbers all you want. I just didn't realize when you see the numbers of people coming, you realize like what on earth can we do as a country and maintain our humanity? And that's a real tough one. I don't know the answer to that. To try to build a workable immigration system will cost billions and billions of dollars. And we could build a wall across, you know, the entire southern border, but I'm not even sure that's going to work. But I think what's the most—
And that would be inhumane.
Yeah, that's the most disturbing thing, which is you look out in the world and you see what's happening and you see the misery and you see that, you know, the desperation of the people who are, you see it in their eyes, who are coming to the border, and it's not, how do you answer the question, what can we do? What can we do as the United States of America, which has always prided itself on being a nation of immigrant, but also like the haven of last resort for people all around the world? What do we do?
Dexter Filkins, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
Staff writer Dexter Filkins. His reporting from the southern border and on the political impasse in Washington appeared in The New Yorker this summer. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. John Lee Clark is a poet, and his debut collection was nominated for a National Book Award this year. The book is called How to Communicate, and that's a central theme for Clark. He writes in English, but he speaks in protactile, an emerging language based on touch that's increasingly used by deaf-blind people. Clark was born deaf and lost his sight when he was young to a condition called Usher syndrome. He was profiled in The New Yorker by the writer Andrew Leland just before Clark's book How to Communicate came out. Here's Andrew Leland.
I first encountered John Lee Clark on an email listserv. Poetry Magazine was about to publish an essay he'd written, and I wrote to him asking for a copy. It was a casual request which began what was, for me, a life-changing correspondence. I have a related disease to Clark's. It's called RP, and it's causing me to slowly lose my sight. In Clark's writing, and in our correspondence, I was struck again and again by the way he described his experience as a deaf-blind person. Despite the rest of the world's tendency to imagine deaf-blind life in tragic terms, as a land of silence and darkness, Clark's writing is full of humor and life. A running theme in his work is the importance of touch, a sense that sighted and hearing people tend to diminish or ignore. Let me give you an example, a poem of his called Clamor. It's being read here by Hallene, or Hal Anderson, a woman who frequently works with John as an interpreter.
Clamor. All things, living and dead, cry out to me when I touch them. The dog, gasping for air, is drowning in ecstasy, its neck shouting, "Dig in, dig in, slam me," demands one door, while another asks to remain open. My wife again asks me, "How did I know? Just where and how to caress her. I can be too eager to listen. The scar here on my thumb is a gift from a cracked bowl that begged to be broken."
To read and write, John usually uses a digital braille display, which converts the text on his computer into refreshable dots of braille on a little electronic device the size of a computer keyboard. As we corresponded, I began to imagine him in his home office in Minnesota, his cat asleep on his feet, playing that braille display like a virtuoso, firing off manifestos and poems and essays at all hours.
Great, yep.
Okay. We met up earlier this fall when he was visiting St. Louis.
Great. Well, John, I'm so glad to see you again, to touch you again, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me again.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. This is great. It's great to be here with you.
That's Hal Anderson again. She's interpreting for John here using a language called protactile. Unlike American Sign Language, or ASL, which is a visual language, protactile happens entirely on the body. Think of rapid-fire taps, squeezes, traces, hand shapes, and presses that are all articulated on the hands, arms, shoulders, upper chest, lower thighs, and even the back.
My hand that's on your knee is giving you feedback. So sometimes when you say something that, as frequently happens, rocks my world, blows my mind, I vigorously agree with, I will pat your knee like this. If you start saying something that I'm gravely, gravely disappointed with or disagree with vehemently, then I'm going to swipe and wipe, because that's the basic protactile that I know. And then if you crack me up, I do a spidery little tickle kind of on your knee.
Yes, absolutely.
Great.
Clark's first language, when he still had his sight as a child, was ASL. It's what his family spoke at home. And we started our conversation talking about that early part of his life.
The first day that I attended school, I went on the bus. And I got on the bus, boarded it, sat down, we took off. My mom didn't trust that I was going to actually like get there and be okay. And so she pulled up kind of behind the bus, she followed along the bus in her car and watched me. And when I got off the bus, she approached me and said, "So how was it? Were you okay?" And I said, I'm fine, but the bus driver seems to forget all how to talk, you know, all of their vocabulary. They couldn't talk with me. And she said, no, they're hearing. And I said, They're hearing? Well, what is that? So my mom had to explain to me that not everyone in the world spoke like we did. So I'm learning that there are other people in the world who essentially couldn't talk. That was a rude awakening.
I love that kind of inversion of how hearing people tend to frame deaf people. And it reminds us that the life of ASL is equal to that of English. And there's no reason why we need to center English in the way that the hearing world does.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. Spot on, Andrew.
Yet, here you are with this magisterial book of poetry in magisterial English. So something happened along the way where you befriended English. And when and how did that happen?
Okay. Well, it's complicated. It's a little complicated. So being a baby, I immediately was immersed in the language of my family. And because I came from a deaf family, other kids knew that I was a source of information to them. You know, they didn't have a whole lot of other deaf role models in their lives. And so I ended up kind of being that for some kids. I took a leadership role as a child among my peers. And as I became more and more blind, as I got older, like, for example, in the sixth grade, I went to a school for the deaf as opposed to that little deaf program. And at that residential school, the school for the deaf, I had to abide by deaf customs, you know, and norms. And so I wound up at a crossroads because I wasn't deaf. I was deaf blind. At that age, even, I was deaf blind. And so I didn't fit the mold. I did not fit the deaf mold. And so, for example, I'll just give you an example here. Waving hands to get someone's attention is something that happens oftentimes. I wouldn't see someone who waved at me, and I would just go about my business, and they would think that I was being extremely rude because I wasn't responding appropriately. So people started to disregard me, to push me away. And so I was more isolated at that point. And so I got involved in books. I was like, well, if you guys are going to go on without me, well, then I've got better things to do than to go off with you, too. And I was hooked on books at that point, because of what they are infected, I guess, with readerly disease, I guess you could call it. Yeah. Because, yeah, books did a whole lot for me. They helped me to get through a really tough time.
Any titles or authors come to mind as primary vehicles for that literary disease that you contracted in sixth grade?
Well, funny you ask. What happened was I entered a drugstore, and they had some mass market books on the shelf. And I had to decide, I'm going to get a book. Okay, what book should I get? So I browsed for a little minute and, of course, happened upon a super thick book, all these other slim volumes. Ah, those aren't for me. I need to go after the biggest book I could find, you know? And it happened to be Ken Follett's The Pillars. The Pillars of the Earth. And I ended up going back to that drugstore to buy other books. Again, those mass market books that they sell. But I noticed, though, in reading them, that it was hard to read them because their print was so small. So I was trying to figure out, well, how can I get a hold of books with bigger print? And I went to the Goodwill. And they had lots of hardcover books. And so I graduated to those because they had larger print. And then after that, ended up going into frequenting used bookstores. And then Barnes & Noble, I'd go through the bins to see which books had the largest font, you know, that was large enough for me to read comfortably. So I didn't choose books based on the story, the content, the topic. If I could read them, if they were legible to me, you know, or visible, I guess, the font size was comfortable, then they passed muster. And it actually helped me. It did take me on a sort of certain trajectory, you know, in literature. I mean, Kafka, Nabokov, you know, those kinds of authors that it just happened to be that their books were printed with larger print. If I wasn't blind, I would probably have just stuck with the mass market media, and maybe I wouldn't have moved out of that genre altogether. So, hidden blessings, Andrew. Mm.
I love that. You talked about this moment when you're realizing that your vision is changing, and it's changing how you, the decisions you make and how you live. And I want to read a poem that I think connects to that experience, which, by the way, you know, is in a very different way, I guess, something that I'm going through myself. You know, so I identify a lot with what you're saying, too, just in terms of being blind. And yet also, you know, I'm about to read this poem off the page, and that's not a oxymoron, I guess.
Absolutely.
Okay. Goldilocks in denial. Goldilocks was in deep denial and refused to use a white cane. That's how she got lost in the woods, stumbling over tree roots and things. Then she hit a wall, a house, door. She entered and wrinkled her nose and remembered the Annie movie from when she was little. It was the part where Daddy Warbucks said, "I smell a wet dog." It was dark inside, so she did her ginger duck walk and zombie arms until she came against a table with some food on it. After emptying a bag of Doritos, she wandered deeper into the house. Kitchen, bathroom, living room, small chair, too small, medium-sized chair, too hard, big recliner. Ah, that's much better. When the three bears got home, they were happy to find that they had company. Papa Bear shook Goldilocks awake and asked, "Who you?" When she didn't answer, Papa Bear put his paw under her hand. She snatched her hand back and said, "I can see." Papa Bear said, "Okay," and asked again, "Who you?" She said, "I'm from Long Island, here vacation." Papa Bear asked, "When arrive here you?" She said, "My name Yellow Curls." Papa Bear asked, "Need help you?" She said, "We'll soon graduate, May." Papa Bear gave up and turned to Mama Bear and said, "Denial, obvious, misunderstand, misunderstand." Mama Bear said, "Sad, yes, nothing can do, leave alone." Baby Bear asked if he could play with Yellow Curls. Mama Bear thought about it and said, "No, better not. Yellow Curls' denial means hard talk, can't play good." So the whole bear clan went about their business as if Goldilocks wasn't sitting there. She jumped up and stamped her feet and said, "Not nice, you ignore, avoid me." She whirled around to make a dramatic exit, but ended up in the bedroom where she stumbled and fell into a bed. She stayed on the bed for a long time, pretending that she had planned to sleep there all along.
Nice. It shows a little bit of denial as a psychological state, right? But what happens later on, if a person's losing their vision or whatever, they sometimes try, I mean, things are overlooked, right? And when accidents do happen, people sometimes will, "Oh, well, I intended to do that." So it's a psychological effect that happens that I went through myself. I noticed myself doing it. And it's a person usually does that when they're not in a great place. But it's a, you know, it's a part of the journey, I would say. You know, it's part of the journey.
There's that moment in the poem when Papa Bear puts his paw underneath her hand in the way that, you know, your hand, the Hal's hand is underneath yours right now. And to me, just because I've spent time with you and have been experienced a protectile, it's clear to me as a somewhat initiated reader that that's a moment of saying, let's communicate tactilely. And part of her denial is to say, no, I can see, I don't need to communicate tactilely. And can you talk about that aspect of becoming deafblind and the way it changes how you communicate?
So as I said, you know, in that period of time where I maybe was in denial and things were getting muddled for me, and I probably did respond as Goldilocks did, off the mark, when people mentioned or said just certain things to me, certain comments, I didn't respond, you know, in kind, but I then became a role model for other deaf people. I'm a teacher, I provide training, I get other deafblind people on board, and when I do that, there are other people who are in that denial phase. And that's tough for me as a teacher, and I think part of that frustration that I have with them potentially is my own frustration at myself, my past self, coming up and revisiting.
That's the poet John Lee Clark communicating through an interpreter using the touch-based language protactile. Clark's story continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi. I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's ZBiotics.com/RadioHour and use the code RadioHour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've been hearing a story about the writer John Lee Clark, a deafblind poet whose debut collection was nominated for a National Book Award this year. And he's recently published a collection of essays called Touch the Future. As the title suggests, Clark writes a lot about the sense of touch. He's an advocate for the language protactile, which uses physical contact between the speakers. Through a protactile interpreter, Clark spoke with our contributor Andrew Leland last year. We'll continue with the interview now.
I want to read another poem.
Yeah.
And this one makes me laugh every time I read it, in part because as a journalist who is writing about deafblind communities, I feel like it's a little bit of a warning sign. It's from Three Squared Cinquains. It's one of the Cinquains. The reporter is in awe. The reporter is in awe of a deafblind man who cooks without burning himself. Helen Keller is to blame. Can't I pick my nose without it being a miracle?
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, I laugh because I'm a reporter and I'm in awe, and yet I want to know how to be impressed with you, John, and your accomplishments. Well, you're strangling me now. But I am. And I wonder, it raises, I think, a tricky and interesting and important question about disability, which is that on the one hand, like, you're doing incredible things. Like, you've written an incredible book of poetry. On the other hand, there is such a risk of becoming that reporter who's in awe. And I wonder, like, how do we avoid that infantilizing, you know, praising you for picking your nose while still recognizing the wonderful stuff you're doing?
Well, I don't know what to advise, but I think for me, I'm a little lucky. You know, one concept maybe, one place of struggle is when lots of people with disabilities are crying, screaming for access. You know, I want access. I want access. We have these rights. We want our rights to be protected. And I think that attitude might lend itself to certain other attitudes in response. And for me, I think I take things a little bit different. My take is a little bit different. I think it can actually be a boon. It can be a benefit when we have less access to the mainstream, because it means they have less access to us. And what that means is we then have at our disposal this beautiful community. I mean, a community that isn't being thrust upon from, by outside forces, we have, I mean, a whole wealth of things that we can then develop and that we can, and we don't have to be stuck with just one world. Within, we can journey into and create all kinds of different approaches and things because we don't have anyone else sort of breathing down our necks, expecting certain things, wanting certain things.
Let me read another one of these Sinkeans just to add it to the conversation.
Okay, go for it.
I think it's a riff on Emily Dickinson. Am I a nobody too?
Yes, you got it.
I had some help from my wife, but am I a nobody too? I am sorry to disappoint, but I am. Yet nobody would let me be one, not even when I catch a bus stinking of nobodies.
Maybe if some readers buy my book, they'll know I'm a deafblind poet at time of purchase. They're in awe just holding it in their hands. They haven't read a single poem, maybe. So they're just in awe even finding out the piece of information of me being deafblind. Wait, a deafblind person got a book of poetry published a book of poetry? No way. The awe is there already. So I hope in those instances, in those cases, I hope that when they open that first cover, I hope that what strikes them first and foremost is a sense of disappointment. I want them to be disappointed. And then I want them to go, oh, this isn't what I thought. This isn't what I thought. And then I hope that they return to the text for the right reasons, Andrew. Mm. I have to tell you, I'm sorry, that I am selfish. I'm a selfish person. I hope that people are in awe because the poetry they read strikes awe in them and that they are amazed by the quality of the poems that's in the book. That's my hope, my selfish hope, Andrew. Mm.
So when we were setting up this interview, you made a joke over email about this tendency where people don't believe that the interpreter is really interpreting what the deafblind person is saying. And when I heard that, I felt really sad, but I also thought, really, you know, that's not going to be something that we're going to deal with today. And then I was talking to a friend who's very bright and really should know better, and he kind of was like, how do you know that's what, you know, that protocol is really a language and that it's not just the interpreter, you know, speaking for John or for the deafblind person. And my heart broke a little bit. And I just, what do you say to that person, you know, to the people out there who may be well-meaning, you know, but still find themselves in awe and even in disbelief of the idea that that protactile has the richness that it does?
I'm not too worried about saying anything to them, to be honest, because I do trust. I have faith in the listeners, Andrew. I trust that what they're imagining is wrong. I have faith that they are going to misconstrue some things and misconceive some things. But in that misconstrual and in some of those misconceptions, they're going to happen upon some things that are true. Many oppressed communities are really concerned with image and with representation, and they stress out about it. They worry. They take pulse, and you know they say, "Oh, how are they recognizing us? And are they really sort of seeing us for who we are? And how are we being portrayed?" And there's a lot of worry on the community's part about PR. I don't have a real connection with that feeling because those of us in the deafblind community, the experiences that we've had have been so rich that honestly, I don't really care. And I don't mean that in a rude way. I don't mean like, I don't care about these people. No. You know, I have friends that are hearing and sighted, and I adore them, I love them. That's not my point. But my point is that I'm not going to deliberate over how to convince other people to approve of me and accept the language I'm using, and I'm not going to be scanning, you know, the horizon for naysayers. I'm going to be like, when this book is published, hey, if you're into it, you know, and that's something that you're eager to delve into, do it. If it doesn't float your boat, move on. That's, you know, with a shrug. I'm too busy to worry much about what that response is in terms of what other people are thinking.
The poet John Lee Clark talking with contributor Andrew Leland. Clark's essay collection, Touch the Future, came out in October. And his debut book of poetry, How to Communicate, was a finalist this year for the National Book Award in Poetry. We heard the voice of Helene Anderson, who translated between spoken English and protactile. I'm David Remnick, and I join everybody at the New Yorker Radio Hour in wishing you a great holiday and a happy new year. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.